Chapter 7. Gideon heard his commanding officer, but he disagreed with her assessment. She might be able to see what was going on, but she couldn't necessarily put it together the way he could, and he had an idea. Out of the corner of his eye, Gideon saw the other three partisans get to their feet. They were good. Their body language conveyed nothing out of the ordinary. If it hadn't been for Sen's translation... "Okay," he said to Shirima, "but I'm getting the data chip first." "No way," said the Pantoran. "You'll get it when Bok and I are both on the ship." Gideon kept his eyes on the bracelet's clasp. He hoped the droid, and therefore Del, had too. Del seemed like a very intelligent and observant man. Gideon hoped the former engineer had figured out what he himself had. "I think your friends might have something to say about that," Gideon drawled. "And I don't want them detonating their bombs before you have a chance to give that chip to me." Everything happened at once. Both Shirima and Bok looked over at their approaching companions. Even as their eyes widened, there came the distinctively distorted shout of an armored stormtrooper.
"Stop right there!"
Quick as a thought, the droid sprang from its perch on Gideon's shoulder and extended its pincers. Two of them snipped through the wire upon which the bomb gems were looped. A third, slender, mechanical arm snatched the chip and retracted, secreting it somewhere inside the droid's metallic innards. The fourth was reaching to catch the seven miniature bombs as they tumbled toward the floor, but Gideon was faster. He grabbed them in one hand before they hit, and closed his other hand tightly around them. Bok and Shirima had risen, and Bok was staring in open-mouthed horror at Gideon. The other two partisans were yelling something and had almost reached Gideon's table. "Go!" he shouted to the droid. It rose straight in the air and zipped over the head of the now wary patrons toward the front of the bar. A stormtrooper stood there, blaster raised. Gideon was almost certain it was Aiden. Almost. He sprang onto his chair, then the table, knocking over the Bespin breezes, and then he too was racing out of the singularity towards the corridor. As his feet hit the metal flooring and put distance between him and the erupting chaos of the singularity, Gideon flung the small, brightly colored, lethal orbs behind him, just as he heard the scream of blaster fire. Then, suddenly, a plastoid-gloved hand seized his arm, yanked him forward, and shoved him farther away from the explosion that momentarily deafened him. He landed hard, and for a horrible second, he couldn't breathe. Then he was hauled to his feet by the stormtrooper. No, Aiden. Aiden, who'd blocked the worst of the blast with her own armor-covered body. And they were racing down the corridors. Gideon's lungs hurt from breathing the overheated air. His whole body hurt, but he ran. More beings pelted past them, fleeing the blast. Others surged toward them, including a cluster of actual stormtroopers. "Rebel bombing! Back of the Singularity!" Aiden shouted. Two of them clattered to a halt, obviously confused that she was running in the opposite direction. Aiden waved them on, gesturing at Gideon, whom she still gripped tightly. "I got this! Go! Go!" Through her heads-up display, Aiden saw the ID-10's careening journey as it zipped along through the corridors at high speed, dodging the panicked throngs and largely ignored. Then the little droid was safely in the ship. Aiden found herself staring into an almost alarming close-up of Miko's concerned face. "What happened?" Then he amended at once. "Never mind. Just grunt if you're both okay." "Yeah," she managed. Relief spread over Del's face like a sunrise.
"Thank goodness. We're monitoring the response to the bombing. Lots of panic, but no one's on to you. I'm doing some editing on the security recordings, and Keitan and Moro have the Corvus ready to leave the second you two get here."
"Copy that," Aiden gasped. Miko's face disappeared, and the droid turned its photoreceptors to the console. It was hovering above Sen, who was, as promised, working frantically at the console. The younger woman glanced up at the droid, and Aiden saw worry furrowing her brow. Then Sen returned her attention to her task. They were almost there. Sen tensed.
"Inferno One, you've got company coming behind you!"
"Damn," Aiden blurted, furious. She and Gideon rounded a corner and found the corridor beautifully empty. They stumbled into the hangar to see the ramp was down. Waiting for them was Del Mico, lean and lanky and thin-lipped with intensity, standing with a blaster at the ready.
"Trooper, halt!"
cried a voice behind Iden. There was no time for this. No time to explain to the poor grunt just doing his job that she was cleared. No time to do anything but shove Gideon forward to run to the ship by himself while Iden whirled, switching her blaster to stun to hold off her fellow stormtroopers. She fired directly at them. They staggered backward, some of them falling. She kept firing circles of blue energy as she went up the ramp, and Del did the same. The ramp retracted and the door slammed shut. Iden and Del tumbled into seats beside Gideon and grabbed for the crash webbing. "Go! Go!" Iden shouted to the pilots, and the Corvus rose, hovered for a second as it continued to be bombarded with lasers, and then escaped to open space. 10 seconds later, white light streaked past, and they were in hyperspace. Failed. I failed. Iden yanked off her helmet and whirled on Gideon. "What the hell, Hask?" she demanded, cold fury making her voice shake. She hated that and fought to get herself under control. "You deliberately disobeyed a direct order!" Gideon looked stunned at her outburst for a second. Then his black brows drew together in a thunderous frown of his own. "This mission turned toxic the instant Bok showed up with an entourage." Zen's normally girlish voice was acidic with disapproval. "We should have aborted immediately. Now we've attracted undue attention and possibly jeopardized one of our key agents." "Your agent is fine," said Gideon. "No one will connect him with this now that everyone's dead?" Iden finished. "Was that what you were about to say? Damn it, people, our job was not that hard. Get one person to safety without being noticed. Now he's dead, his friend is dead." Gideon cut her off. "Yeah, that's right. 5 partisans are dead, casualties of their own violence when their terrorist bombing went terribly wrong. That means it's very likely that the Dreamers are the only ones left." But Sen wasn't buying it. "Irrelevant. This mission was to extract Bok and obtain information from him. And now he's dead and we're no better. No, we are worse off than we were before. By any measure, it's a failure." Her eyes flashed. "Initial security recordings indicate that 2 of our potential Imperial blackmail victims were wounded in the blast as well. We are very fortunate they weren't killed." "Our contact's dead," Iden thought to herself. "Gideon killed him. Sen's right. By any measure, it's a failure." "Captain Versio?" It was Miko, sounding a little sheepish. "I may not agree how this went down, but we may not have blown the intent of the mission." Iden stayed silent for a moment, hardly daring to hope. Then she said to Miko, "Did I see what I think I saw there? Before Gideon decided to unleash hell?" Gideon's lips thinned at the comment. "Droid, show us what you've got," Del instructed the ID-10. It had fastened itself securely to the Corvus's bulkhead for the jump to hyperspace. Now it bleeped, detached itself, and floated over to Miko. It extended one of its arms. In its metallic pincers, it grasped a data chip the size of Iden's pinky fingernail. Carefully, Iden took the chip, holding it by the edges, and handed it to Sen. The younger woman was silent, then she turned and inserted it into the console. Letters from a variety of alphabets, including pictographic ones, along with numerals, flashed rapidly on the screen. "It's encrypted, of course," Sen murmured almost to herself. "But you may be right. We may not have Bok, but we might have some of what he knew." Gideon and Iden regarded each other.
"Apology accepted," Gideon said at last.
"Oh, I'm not apologizing," Iden replied stonily. "To any of you. Hask, you disobeyed a direct order and put yourself, your commanding officer, and the rest of the team in jeopardy." She looked over at Sen. "Morana, you did not suggest that we abort the mission. You demanded it, twice. Miko, you aided Gideon's disobedience when you decided to have your pet project snatch the data chip and abscond with it," she finished. Everyone was quiet. Iden ran a hand through her sweat-damp hair and sighed. "And, as it turned out, Sen, you were right," Iden admitted.
The situation was dangerous, and we should have gotten out right away and planned a second rendezvous. Gideon, you retrieved a data chip we hope will prove to be full of useful information, and by your actions, we've eliminated 5 known partisans. And Del, your quick thinking got us the chip before said partisans decided to take matters into their own hands.
There was a long, awkward silence.
Permission to speak freely? Gideon asked after a strained moment. Go ahead.
Thanks for the... He broke off and amended. Thanks for the acknowledgement.
Aiden smiled thinly and nodded.
She took a deep breath.
Now we just have to present this to Admiral Versio in a way that looks like we are still a smoothly functioning machine. The droid, an actual smoothly functioning machine, booped in what sounded like sympathy. As it turns out, while Admiral Versio was not at all happy with how things had gone down, he surprised Aiden with his final opinion at their debriefing in his office.
Anyone can craft the perfect plan for how a mission should go, he told them.
Aiden's stomach tightened.
But the execution is something else again. I've spoken with Bok's contact. He was surprised to learn that Bok had changed the terms of the deal. If he, who had worked with the Sulliston for months, had not expected the, twist, you could not be expected to.
Aiden blinked. She had not anticipated such magnanimity from her father. Whatever else he'd learned must have pleased him greatly.
As it had always been the intention to terminate Bok, once he had revealed his information, I believe we lost very little. What was on the chip was extremely useful, and the entire...
He searched for the word.
Turn of events during your mission might work in our favor.
Aiden waited. It might not have been a disaster, but it was bad enough. It wasn't perfect. So she waited for him to single out the others for their responses. Waited for him to give the position of leader to someone else. He did not. After a moment, she said,
May we be informed about what you learned from the chip, sir?
In due time, and as it pertains to your mission, Captain, Versio said.
He sat down at the head of the table.
Aiden blinked.
It was the first time ever that her father had sat down in a professional meeting. He folded his hands.
I've made the decision to expand Inferno Squad's responsibilities in order to best utilize the information we have obtained on the partisans, he said. As you will recall, I described the squad as being cleaners, tracking down and recovering sensitive information, informants, defectors, and so on, usually with quick precision attacks or incursions. For instance, your recent mission to the Telic 4 station, both planned and how it actually unfolded, was a military extraction operation. Despite the complications, you succeeded. You'll still be cleaners, but your next mission is going to be reminiscent of your first one. If all goes well, this could mean the end of the Dreamers in a single swoop.
The 4 exchanged glances, but they all held their tongues.
As was discussed earlier, the Rebel Alliance has a mostly unified front, while the Partisans have always preferred to operate in 1 or 2 small cells with little or no connection.
The most recent intel says that with the explosion on Singularity, the Dreamers is the sole remaining functional Partisan cell. I've already told you that the Dreamers have likely obtained what could be potentially devastating intel. The information on the recovered data chip, among other things, appears to confirm this.
There wasn't any murmuring. Not quite. But the room was filled with swift intakes of breath and the creaking of chairs as their occupants shifted.
It might seem that the logical thing would be to simply go in and destroy it. While that would indeed wipe out the enemy in one attack, We'd also be destroying our chance to discover how the intel has fallen into the partisan hands, who knows about it, and who controls the data flow. And so that means we need Inferno Squad to not just extricate information, but infiltrate the Dreamers. Iden caught movement out of the corner of her eye. It was Sen. She did not look at all comfortable with this statement. Truth be told, Iden wasn't either. But she had learned not to question, just to do, succeed, excel. That was what Versios did. Any questions before I go over your specific assignments?
I have one, sir, Sen said. We have agents trained precisely for this sort of thing, and we've even attempted to infiltrate the partisans before. Why is Inferno Squad being sent instead of another ISB agent?
A smile quirked the Admiral's lips. Do you think you aren't up to it, Lieutenant? I can certainly replace you on the squad, if so.
Sen stiffened. Of course I am, sir. But I'm wondering why you think this team is a better choice.
You've answered your own question, Lieutenant. ISB has, indeed, sent in agents before. None of them was successful. We can't afford to fail this time. I have nothing but respect for the brave agents of the ISB. The partisans, especially the Dreamers, are a military group, not a corporation or a government organization. Any agents sent in would also have to be trained to operate a variety of weapons and vessels. You will all see a lot of action, and you'll be asked to do things you might find distasteful. Up to and including possibly having to actively participate in attacks against your own people to protect your cover. Iden blinked. That hadn't occurred to her. The Empire was certainly not overly compassionate. It understood sacrifice and duty, unlike the rebels. But this quietly horrified her. Then she thought about the partisans, who had shown up at a bar wearing bombs disguised as jewelry and hardened her heart. She did understand sacrifice. If she had to kill some Imperials to save the rest, to save all of what the Empire stood for, she would do it. Considering all that, I feel this assignment is a superb opportunity to showcase all that Inferno Squad is capable of. And then Iden understood. She'd seen this type of behavior from her father before. Whatever was on that ship was something Garrick Versio thought he could turn to his advantage. Inferno Squad had been his brainchild. Its success, Iden's success, would be his. She was conflicted. On one hand, he was using the team to climb his way higher in the eyes of the Emperor. On the other hand, he thought enough of her to involve her in his continued rise to power. His eyes, almost reptilian in their flat coldness, roamed over the four of them. If anyone feels they cannot complete this mission as I have outlined it, please speak up now. There was silence. As I thought. Now to the details. The data chip revealed the following. Versio began to tick points off on his fingers. First, it confirmed our suspicions that the Dreamers have indeed acquired sensitive information. The group is led by a man known only as Staven. We have apprehended Staven, and until Saw's death, he was rotting in a prison cell. Somehow he managed to escape, and he has apparently kept himself quite busy gathering hardcore recruits who are passionate about Saw and his mission. Anyone else named other than Staven? No, unfortunately. That might have been Bok's contribution had he survived. Iden tightened her jaw. Her father continued. We do, however, have the names of a few notable Dreamer sympathizers. And finally, we know the Dreamer's next target. Iden schooled her face to remain calm. But inwardly, her heart leapt. She knew that the others struggled similarly. We've run all of this data by intel, and it looks sound as far as we are able to determine, Versio continued. The one thing we don't know, however, is where the Dreamers are based, Which means we'll need to convince them to take us there. Versio allowed himself a slight smile at their confusion. Here's how this is going to work. The Dreamers are planning an attack approximately 2 standard weeks from now. We're going to let it proceed unhindered. Versio had not exaggerated his warning to them. The very first thing they would be doing in this infiltration mission would be allowing people to die. Versio directed their attention to a holo projector in the table. A space station that looked like it had been haphazardly thrown together rather than deliberately designed turned slowly in the center. "This is Otor's hub," Versio said. "It's located in the Ojoster section of the Outer Rim. It's a popular way station for travelers."
"So sort of like Telic 4?" Miko asked.
"Telic 4 is a fairly straightforward refueling and repair station and operates formally within the auspices of the Empire. This place is far more unsavory. Most of its merchants deal in the black market or the slave market. There is a small cluster of merchants there who do a bit of spying for us on the side. They know to notify us if a person of interest patronizes their shop or if a certain item crosses their path. It's a loose association, but a useful one. It turns out that the Dreamers have discovered our involvement with the merchants, and they've decided to put an end to it. That sort of enterprise isn't really in keeping with the data leak you're concerned with, sir," Gideon said. "It seems more personal than political." "It does. And it likely is," Versio agreed. "But the partisans have ever been ones to smart against the perceived insult and hold grudges. That is entirely in keeping with their operation. I regret the necessity of sacrificing these merchants. They've been useful over the years. But I'm certain others will spring up to fill the vacuum."
Aiden was nodding, relaxing a little. She had no problem with the idea of money-grubbing black marketers on the receiving end of Dreamer justice, much preferable to the thought of sacrificing Imperial lives. Versio continued.
"There's one merchant who's mentioned specifically by name. A Dug, even more unpleasant than most of his species, known for dealing in antiquities, mostly fake, and information, mostly true. We will approach this rude Daga and inform him that Lieutenant Morana is one of our agents. She will pose as his slave. People will grow accustomed to her presence at the shop, so she won't attract any attention the day of the attack. He'll teach the lieutenant enough about the business so the partisans won't suspect her." Versio now spoke directly to the youngest member of the group. "You have an eidetic memory, and I've spoken with your superiors. Apparently, once you see something, you can replicate it, and you've done so on a few occasions previously."
"Yes, sir."
"Then you will claim you've been trained in forgery by your master. It's a valuable skill for the Dreamers to have. That, and your sad story of mistreatment by your master, will make it likely the Dreamers will take you with them once they've eliminated their targets."
The Admiral slid a data pad over to her.
"Your bio is here. Memorize it. And, as I'm certain you anticipated, we're going to have to do some work on you before you go. Per our standard operating procedure in these cases, everything we do, we'll undo at the completion of your assignment."
Aiden was confused. Sen seemed to know exactly what Versio meant, but Aiden was at a loss. So too, it seemed, was everyone else on the team.
"Excuse me, sir," Gideon ventured. "But what do you mean, work?"
It was Sen, not the Admiral, who answered.
"He means that my body is going to be altered to corroborate my cover story. It's commonplace for undercover operations like this."
She seemed calm, almost clinically detached from her words. With growing unease, Aiden found herself speaking up.
"Altered how?"
"As she is purporting to be an escaped slave, Lieutenant Morana will need to display visible signs of abuse," Versio said, in the same neutral, professional tone he might use to discuss his calf preference. "The question is, Do we want to make it appear that the injuries have been accumulated from long-term mistreatment, or recent? Scars, brands, calluses on her hands, that sort of thing. That sort of thing.
I see, Aiden said. Understood.
The thought of any member of her team having to be mutilated in order to fulfill the mission made her uncomfortable, but Aiden did understand. Everything rested on them being able to convince the partisans that they were sincere. And no one knew that better than Sen. If anything, the youngest member of the team would have suggestions as to how to make her own scarification more believable.
Once we're done with the meeting, there's a specialist I'd like you to consult with. You can go over the options together. Shum Lauder, perhaps you know him.
We've not met, but I've seen his work. It's entirely convincing.
Good.
Versio turned to the two young men.
Now, another useful thing we learned from the chip is that the Dreamers have a fairly regular supplier of food and often weapons. We have a plan for getting you aboard her ship, and she'll take you right to them. The two of you will be posing as a pair of brothers.
Aiden had to admit that it made sense. Both had dark hair, brown eyes, and similar features, although Gideon's skin was paler. But they were hardly alike in demeanor. She was an only child and had only the vaguest notion of how brothers would interact. The two men in question exchanged glances, then hid bemused smiles.
Your particular challenge will be to cultivate an extra layer of believability to convincingly pass as siblings. For the next week, not only will you live together in the same unit and share the same room, you'll eat all of your meals together, train together, and rehearse your stories together. By the time you're done, you should feel as though you truly do have a brother.
I have two brothers, Del said confidently.
We'll be fine. I expect no less, Agent. And if you do your jobs right and convince her, she'll take you with her. If you don't, make no mistake, she'll execute you on the spot.
How charming, Hask said. He'd mistaken the brother approach for lightness on Versio's part, and Aiden knew at once that it was a mistake. Versio narrowed his eyes.
She's a pirate, and her reputation is quite terrifying. Her group is called the Blood Bone Order. I've included information on your datapads. I suggest you read it thoroughly.
He passed them their datapads. Gideon accepted his without further comment.
Hask, you will present yourself as the pilot of the pair. Miko, you're the technician. Simple is always best, and remember, any lie is more effective if it holds some truth in it. Your droid will accompany you. Give some thought to what will serve a rebel group well, and tailor its upgrades to that.
They both replied, "Yes, sir," at the same time. Aiden straightened in her chair and looked at her father with a calm, expressionless face. Sen was to be a slave and have her body scarified for the role. The men were being drafted into a pirate's crew. What horror did her father have in store for her?
Now then, Admiral Versio said, as for your commanding officer, I have saved the best for last.
Aiden tensed. Versio turned to the rest of them.
Aiden will be leaving us shortly. She is to be stationed on a new Star Destroyer.
Aiden felt the blood drain from her face.
Sir?
Don't worry. You're taking different paths to get there, but you'll all eventually rendezvous.
Dismissed.
Aiden waited as the others filed out. Del cast a concerned glance back at her. Then the door closed, and she was alone with her father.
What do you have in mind for me, sir? As I said, you'll be stationed on a Star Destroyer.
I don't understand.
There was one final piece of information on that ship. The Dreamers themselves are emotionally rallying behind their founder, Saw. They want to realize his vision. But Saw is gone, and his name can no longer be used as the public face of the true partisans. They need a new one. We're giving them yours.
Chapter 8.
The things we do for the Empire, Gideon said,
sighing melodramatically.
I hear you, Del said. I mean, fighting and dying is one thing, but stowing away in this death trap of a ship?
Do you think we'll get hazard pay?
If we get out of this alive, I think we could make an excellent case for it.
He grinned at Del, who returned it.
Despite their slightly feigned complaints about their cramped quarters and steady diet of delicious ration cubes, things had gone well so far. True to his word, Admiral Versio had seen to it that the two brothers were constantly in each other's company. Del had been a little worried initially. He and Gideon did not seem like two people who would naturally gravitate toward each other. In the end, though, the shared adventure aspect bonded them. The plan was simple, but there were many places where things could go wrong. Success hinged on greed, timing, and luck. Fortunately for the moment, the brothers Farron would be able to contact the Admiral should something go awry. If, for example, the wrong group of pirates ended up attacking the ship. A large handful of credits delivered by one of the Empire's many shadowy figures convinced a Deveronian smuggler named Kurjak to take on a large force field protected container, no questions asked. It was to be delivered to Eriadu, the end of the smuggler's run, where someone would be waiting to receive it in 6 days' time. Someone indeed would be waiting to receive the container, provided the ship, known as the Fast Friend, actually made it to its final destination. Research had concluded that the ship's path would take it into dangerous space where Lhasa Raym, the cruel leader of the Bloodbone Order, was known to strike. It seems funny to say, with luck we'll be captured by pirates, Del had commented as they prepared for the journey.
Better than having to go through the whole ordeal a second time,
Gideon had replied, and Del had to admit, he was right. The three of them, Del Farron, Gid Farron, and the droid, spent almost the entire journey in the container, sneaking out during times when the crew slept in order to grab some exercise and visit the restroom. They'd swapped battle stories, tales of their childhood, and reminiscences of girls they'd known all too fleetingly. The Empire was a demanding master, and there was little time for personal relationships.
"We're living on borrowed time, people like us," Del had said one evening.
He had loaded up the droid with games and holovids to while away the time, and they were currently playing a travel version of Dejarik.
"You've borrowed more than I have," Gideon had replied.
"Thanks for the reminder, baby brother."
"Seriously, retirement is just around the corner. You need someone to settle down with."
Del shook his head.
"Nope. Wouldn't be fair."
"You?"
"Nah. I've got my eyes on a command."
He moved a piece. The tiny holographic creature emitted a small squeal of delight as it destroyed Del's.
"Does Iden know?"
Gideon laughed.
"Yes, she does."
Once again, Gideon had evaded a serious answer. Del noticed that his brother was close-mouthed about his childhood, opening up only when it came to his time at the future Imperial Leader's military preparatory school on Vardos, and later at the Academy. Del knew he'd lost his family to a rebel bombing at a young age. It wasn't surprising, then, that Gideon seemed almost hungry to hear stories about Del's family and two older brothers who also served in faraway positions in the Empire. Gideon struck Del as someone who was eager to connect with others, yet pushed them away simultaneously. There was an edge to his humor, a coldness that Del supposed came with the tragedy that had struck him so young.
"And now look at you," Gideon had said. "You've risen higher in the ranks than anyone else in your family."
Del had laughed at that, gesturing to the 3-square-meter compartment lit only by the blue holographic glow the ID-10 emitted. He picked up the ration cube.
"I'm living like the Emperor himself," he had said.
They both laughed,
then suddenly quieted. Even here, even now, one did not joke about the Emperor.
They were halfway through the fourth day and were slowly running out of things to talk about. During a long silence, as they sat in the darkness to conserve their light, Del said,
"I wonder if we are going to have to do all this over again?" "I desperately hope not. I'd rather face the torture droid than 6 more days in a container with you."
Suddenly, a screeching klaxon sounded. Gideon activated his glow rod, and the two looked at each other excitedly. They waited a moment to see if it was a false alarm, but when the ear-splitting sound continued and the ship rocked violently, they had their answer. Del deactivated the force field and they leapt out, grabbing their packs and their blasters. The ID-10 rose behind them, providing light for the two to navigate their way around towering crates of illegal goods. Another barrage of cannon fire caused the old ship to shudder. The pair were knocked to the floor. Just as they clambered to their feet, there was a sudden blaze of orange and yellow flame, and then everything, including Del and Gideon, was being drawn toward the suddenly gaping hole in the hull. The ID-10's metallic arms shot out, its pincers grabbing the two by the collars of their jackets. The other pair of arms fastened themselves firmly to the bulkhead as the smaller containers of ill-gotten gains were sucked out into space. Just as Del was convinced that one highly modified ID-10 droid and two hapless humans would be next, the pressure stabilized, and normal gravity returned. The droid released them. Gideon looked at it with surprise and respect. "Strong little guy," he said.
"I reinforced his joints and added a magnet," Del said.
"Good thinking,"
Gideon said as he and Del slumped against the bulkhead and looked toward where the hole had been. Their domicile of the last 4 days had plugged it. Astonished and gleeful, they looked at each other and started to laugh.
The smuggling compartment was locked, but that had never been a problem. Over the last 4 days, the droid had opened and locked it for them on request.
At this moment, their goal was to stay alive long enough to surrender themselves to the Bloodbone Order, and now that the fighting had begun, they were determined to do what they could to help the pirates take the ship. The two Inferno Squad members hurried through corridors drenched in blood-red lighting, pausing to blast any member of the crew unfortunate enough to come across them. The droid, too, went on the offensive, attacking with electroshock prods. They emerged onto the bridge where, despite sparking and sometimes smoking consoles, the smugglers were doing their best to fend off the pirates.
"Looks like the cargo area was hit!"
one of them shouted over the din. The captain shouted a long string of something in Huttese, following it up with,
"Make them pay for the lost cargo."
The pirate ship fired again. Del and Gideon stayed out of sight, watching and waiting. The droid fastens itself to Del's back.
"Direct hit on the engines!"
The screen on the main console suddenly flickered to life. The figure was only a third of a meter tall, but imposing even at the diminutive height. It was a Pantoran female, with blue skin and a long braid of lighter-hued hair. She wore a black jacket, boots, and snug-fitting pants. She had a blaster in one hand, and what looked like a cutlass in the other.
"I am Lassa Rame, captain of the Opportunity and head of the Bloodbone Order," she said in a clear, strong voice. "Prepare for either boarding or becoming target practice. Which'll it be?"
The two humans looked at each other, grinning. Gideon gave Del a thumbs up. Korjak drooped in defeat, sighing deeply. Rame put a hand to her ear, an exaggerated look of confusion on her tattoo-free, beautiful face.
"What's that? Target practice? Sounds fine."
"No," Korjak retorted. "We surrender. Damn you, blue-skinned devil."
"Devil, am I? Look who's talking. All right, I'll think about it."
The pirate captain smiled, and her image disappeared. It was all over after that. By the time the Opportunity had planted the grappling harpoons and hauled the ship close enough for boarding, Gideon and Del had either eliminated or trussed up the crew of the Fast Friend and were awaiting the pirate's arrival. Lassa Rame liked to call herself a pirate queen, and while it was undoubtedly self-aggrandizing, reports claimed that she was always among the first to board a captured ship, so she could terrorize the crew herself. They heard the clank of the boarding tube connecting. Del glanced over at Gideon.
"Think she'll give us a chance to speak?"
"Don't know," Gideon replied. "I do know if we meet her with blasters blazing, we'll be cut down without a second thought, so let's hope she'll listen. I'd rather be fighting than hoping."
"Me too,"
Gideon said.
"Ready?"
"Ready." Del placed his hands behind his head. Gideon pressed the controls to unlock the door, then stepped back quickly, imitating Del. The door opened, and the striking black-clad, blue-skinned Pantoran of the hologram, Lassa Rame, the pirate queen of the Bloodbone Order, stepped onto the ship. Two of her crew followed her. She was much taller than Del had expected. Almost as tall as they were, and neither Imperial was short. Her braid, as it turned out, was lavender, and her golden eyes looked vibro-daggers at both the humans.
"You're mighty obliging," she said. "Usually someone has a death wish along about now."
"We do have a request," Gideon said. She rolled her eyes.
"Fine, I'll kill you quickly,"
she said, and lifted the blaster. Another Bloodbone pirate emulated his captain and aimed his blaster at Del.
"No, don't! We're partisans!" Del shouted quickly.
Lassa froze.
"Cover this one," she said,
and the pirate stepped forward, smirking as he retrained his weapon on Gideon. The pirate queen's arm shot out, grabbed Del by the collar, slammed him up against the bulkhead, and pressed the tip of her blaster to his forehead.
"Start talking," she said, "and you'd better hope I like what I hear."
"We're partisans," Del stammered.
"You said that. Go on."
"I'm Del Ferrin, and that's my brother Gid. We were part of the Nebula Cell. We were at the Telic 4 station when the Singularity bombing happened." The golden eyes didn't waver.
"I heard about that bombing."
Del wondered how much she knew about the logistics of the situation. In their haste to depart after the event, he almost hadn't taken the time to edit the security recordings. He was profoundly grateful he had. Our cell had been compromised. Some of us volunteered to do a suicide bomb attack. The rest of us were going to join the Dreamers.
"Why Telic 4?
"We knew what ships were coming in. We knew the habits of some of the Imperial officers. They went to that bar often. We figured we'd kill who we could while causing a distraction. Some of us would die so we could escape, try to make our way to join the Dreamers.
Box said we could trust you." Admiral Versio had pointed out that in any recordings of the event, Gideon and the droid would show up. He would be seen talking with known partisans. He would also be seen flinging bombs over his shoulder as he fled out of the bar. But thanks to Del's hacking, there were serendipitous bursts of static that had obscured anything that might give them away. And as there was no one left of the cell to dispute the claim, it stood as compelling support to their story. The question was it going to be compelling enough? Lassa Rame frowned, glancing from one to the other. Finally, she said to one of her people,
"Take them. I'll verify this. In the meantime, let's haul some cargo."
Del and Gideon were taken none too gently aboard the Opportunity, where they were put in a small holding cell. They were given water but nothing else, and their packs and the droid were confiscated. Del wasn't worried. He'd made some adjustments that would bury anything related to Inferno Squad unless a certain code was entered. Unless the pirates were exceptional hackers, the information was safe. Going on the assumption that they were being observed and listened to, they spoke little, and when they did, they made sure they said nothing to jeopardize their story. Their time as undercover operatives had well and truly begun. Del just hoped that it would last longer than a few hours. At last, the door was opened. The man who had trained his blaster on Gideon filled the doorway. His weapon was in its holster at his hip.
"Lassa wants to see you," he said. "Follow me."
Lassa awaited them in a large, comfortably decorated cabin. There was a bed, a trunk, a table and chairs, and a sideboard with glasses and a bottle of amber liquid. She looked them up and down as they entered, then nodded to her crew member that he could go. The two men stood quietly, waiting.
"Sit," Lassa said.
They sat. She poured three glasses and set two of them down in front of her captives. Or were they guests now? Raising her own glass, she said,
"To absent friends."
They drank. It was whiskey, and it burned warm and sweet as it slipped down Del's throat.
I only met Bach once, the Pantoran said, leaning back in her chair and putting her boots on the table as she rolled the empty glass between her fingers. I'll bet he was glad to die doing something he believed in. With any luck, we'll all go that way. Making a difference. Del's eyes slid over to Gideon's, whose face was carefully neutral. Lassa didn't miss the glance, and she emitted a soft, throaty laugh. So you're thinking those are strange words coming from the leader of the Bloodbone Order, right? Would it surprise you to learn that I let that horned Sleemo and what crew members you didn't blast go on his way, after lightening his load, of course? Another exchanged look, then Gideon nodded slowly. We thought you'd kill them all. It's what all the stories about you say. Lassa reached for the bottle and refilled her glass, waving that they should slide theirs over for the same treatment. Don't you know, darling boys, she purred, that stories are fiction? Oh, I've taken my share of lives, but always to save my own, or those of my crew. I just like to let people think I'm going to skin them alive. It makes capturing ships so much easier and poses much less damage to the cargo. Del was dumbfounded. Gideon started laughing. Well, he said after a moment, you certainly fooled us. And good Captain Korjak, too. Del smothered a smile at his last memory of Korjak, hurling insults as Rame's pirates tied him to his command chair. He wondered if the Deveronian had figured out that he could escape. Gideon took another drink of the whiskey.
This is excellent, by the way.
Lassa cocked a pale lavender brow. Partisans generally don't know much about fine alcohol. There was no trace of suspicion in the comment, but Del wondered. Gideon nodded. My brother and I don't know about vintages or cask whatever, things like that. We just know when something isn't swill. Oh, this is definitely not swill. Aged Tevraki whiskey. Very good stuff, but I break it out on rare occasions. Like saying goodbye to old friends. Her good humor faded, replaced by wistfulness. I knew Saw back in the day. Never knew his sister, Stila. Wish I had. She'd have made a fine member of the Order. She might be still alive today, had she. Well, she swirled the amber liquid in the glass. Let's just say you partisans sure like to burn through your numbers. It was a good opening, and Gideon took it.
Empire likes to do it even more than we do, he said darkly.
That's why we fight, and we'll keep fighting with the last breath in our bodies.
We all fight in our own ways, she said.
Maybe it was the whiskey. Gideon had been right. It was excellent, and it was strong, too. But Del piped up and said,
If you don't like killing, why are you helping us?
Why not help the Rebel Alliance, or stay out of it altogether? She nodded.
Fair question. It's because I'm sentimental.
Her gold eyes glinted with a hint of amusement, and her smile was warm. Del had not been prepared for how attractive she was. Nor had he been prepared to admire her quite so much. She reminded him of Aiden. Strong, take charge, beautiful, smart. He frowned a little. Aiden? Why was he thinking about her? Oh yes, he thought. It's definitely the whiskey.
I've been around a while. I've seen a lot of things. I know when things are simmering, ready to boil over. When something's going to disappear and never be seen in the galaxy again. The partisans are becoming extinct. You were dying out when Jedha happened. The Rebel Alliance, they're growing. They don't need me.
She smiled, an almost motherly smile.
You do.
The answer seemed to surprise Gideon. And by this point, as he drained his glass and held it out for more,
All Dell felt he could safely do was stay silent. After a moment, Lhasa said, "And so, that is a very long answer to your question, Gid. And the answer to another question as well. Yes, I will see that you get to Geosyn safely." Geosyn, at last, Dell thought. They had the name of the Dreamers' base of operations. "I'm heading there with some supplies for the Dreamers, so it won't even take long." Lhasa smiled slyly. "But I bet you knew that." Dell grinned sheepishly. Gideon said, "Bok knew." "Very good. But as you've got no way of paying for your transportation, I'll have to take it out of you in work. I have a couple of bunks open for you and some clean clothes you can wear. But first," she wrinkled her nose delicately, "you both need a bath."
Chapter 9.
"Hey, Aiden, wait up." Captain Aiden Versio had captivated Tarvin Larika from the moment she showed up on the Determination, dressed in TIE pilot black, wrapped in Imperial legacy, and crowned with the rare aura of a Death Star survivor. When she was in a room, she owned it, even if she stood quietly at attention like all the rest of them. Hers was not a common beauty, but stemmed from her straight back and fierce dark eyes. And, Tarvin had to admit, her smooth, warm-hued skin and lustrous black hair also helped to make her unforgettable. Of course, conspiracy theories had abounded as to why Aiden Versio had survived when so many others had not. "Double agent," someone had whispered. "Force user," others said. "Her dad arranged for her tie to be modified," still others said. But anyone who watched her pilot her vessel could see that it wasn't anything other than damn fine skills that had saved her life. In fact, it was the thing that had edged Tarvin from simple respect to, well, kind of a crush, he supposed. He'd never seen such ability. Watching her fly was more like watching an aerial performance than a regular military maneuver. Which was why he was having a hard time coming to grips with what had just happened. It had been a skirmish, not a battle, fortunately. One of many that the Determination had encountered in its patrols in the Midrim. But something about Aiden had been off today. While the Empire had defeated the small handful of foolish rebels, Aiden had missed shots she should have easily been able to take, and had been slow in coming around at times. He'd overheard their team leader dressing her down and watched out of the corner of his eye as Aiden's cheeks had flushed, though her beautiful face remained as implacable as ever. Now, as they were heading back from the debriefing, Tarvin wanted to catch up to her and find out why her game was off. Maybe something was wrong. Maybe he could help. She didn't slow, and he had to break into a jog to reach her, taking the time to awkwardly smooth the stubborn tuft of hair that never wanted to obey. He fell into step behind her. She gave him a quick glance, then lowered her head, almost like a reek about to charge, and kept going. "Aiden," he began, but she cut him off. "I'm fine." She obviously wasn't, and she had to know it. He wanted to reach out and take her arm, but knew the gesture wouldn't be welcomed. So he simply said, "You don't seem fine. You missed at least 2 clear shots, and that's not like you." "I took out 2 others." "Yeah, but I took out 3, and we both know my count beating yours is not normal." He grinned, and he saw her start to smile. "Well," she admitted, "you're right about that. I just..." She glanced around at all the other crew members striding briskly past them and lowered her voice. Everything changed after the Death Star, you know." Tarvin nodded, sobering. He did know. "I started thinking about everyone we lost, and I got so angry. And then I started thinking about Alderaan. I mean..." She brushed a sweat-damp lock of hair from her forehead. "The rebels attacked a battle station with no civilians, only people who had signed up to be there. We attacked a whole planet that didn't even have defenses." Tarvin felt himself grow pale as she spoke, and this time he did reach out to grasp her arm, gently, in warning. This is a bad place to talk, he said. Indeed, heads were already starting to turn in their direction. Others couldn't hear the conversation, but they could see the look of distress on Iden's face. A sure sign, if anyone knew her, that there was something gravely amiss. We're off duty in 2 hours. Meet me at the bar. We'll talk more, okay? She nodded, and quickly composed herself. Another thing Tarvin admired about her. He'd been told his whole life he wore his heart on his sleeve. He blamed his fair coloring. It betrayed him constantly. 2 hours, she said. See you then. And Tarvin? Yeah, she smiled. His heart flipped over. Thanks. He watched her stride away on her long legs, head high, as if nothing in the world was wrong. But there was. And she'd confided in him. Tarvin understood that some people were having a harder time adjusting to the loss of the Death Star than others. Iden was clearly upset. He wanted help, and he thought he knew how. He was seated at a table in a little alcove in the back by the time Iden had arrived. They'd both changed into fresh uniforms, and since she was off duty, Iden had unpinned her hair from the neat bun she usually wore. It fell loose about her shoulders. He'd already ordered and was sipping a beer. Iden flagged down the serving droid and ordered a whiskey, neat. They were silent until the droid returned. Then they sent it on its way. Tarvin waited for her to speak first. I probably shouldn't have said anything to you, she said. No, no, he assured her quickly. I'm glad you did. Really, what happened to the Death Star? You're not the only one who was shaken up. And I can't imagine how strange it must be to have survived that. She grimaced and took another sip of the amber beverage. No, she said, I don't think anyone can. I can't stop thinking about it. I can't stop seeing Alderaan either. She lifted dark eyes to his. Tarvin, we shouldn't have done it. Tarvin froze in his feet. His heart thudded rapidly. Go on, he said. I mean, the rebel base? Fine. Destroyed the rebellion and the criminals. They brought everything on themselves. But an entire planet? Her voice rose, and Tarvin placed a hand on hers to remind her to speak quietly. She didn't pull away. A lot of hostile, dangerous rebels died that day. There's no doubt about that. But a lot of other people did, too. People who didn't agree with the rebellion. People who maybe even didn't know what was going on. Children. Resources, animals, plants found nowhere else in the galaxy, all for a display of power. And now we're hunting those few who were off-world for no reason other than that they've had the misfortune of surviving the death of everything they've loved. Tarvin sat, stunned. It was worse than he'd feared. Iden was identifying with the other survivors. He was glad he'd asked her to talk. He could get her help. He squeezed the strong hand that still rested beneath his own. Iden took it as a sign to continue. I don't want to be a part of mass murder, she said simply. When I saw Alderaan, a place that offered no real physical threat to the Empire, just blown to pieces, she shook her head. Then the Empire came after those who hadn't even been on the planet. Those poor people are being hunted down like animals. This is wrong, Tarvin. The Empire says it wants to help people, but instead it's erased an entire planet filled with them? How can I have seen that with my own eyes and be able to look myself in the mirror ever again? Tarvin stared at her, trying to mitigate his horror at her words. Iden, but it was as if the emotions had been pent up inside her and now spilled forth in a flood. The Empire must be swept away. It needs to go. And you know what else? I think the partisans were right. I think violence is the only thing the Empire really understands. It certainly knows how to utilize it against helpless people. Iden, Tarvin said gently, his heart full of pain for her. This isn't you. You're just confused. I'm gonna help you, Iden. Others will too. You'll see. Her eyes widened suddenly, and her gaze slid away to the rest of the bar, watching, worried. With his other hand, the one that wasn't placed over Iden's, Tarvin clicked off the recording, then transmitted it to their commanding officer. A few seconds later, it vibrated in his hand, and he read a message. "Coming. You did the right thing."
"It's gonna be all right," he said. "I promise. I remember right after the explosion, Commander Udre took our squadron aside. He told us that if any of us felt troubling thoughts, to come forward and ask for help. It's normal to feel like that. And especially since you survived it." Iden jerked her hand back and clenched it into a fist. "Tarvin, what have you done?" He felt bad about deceiving her, but it was for her own good. "I recorded this conversation, and I just sent it to Commander Udre." Iden bolted upright, knocking the chair over. She looked around wild-eyed, an animal in a trap. The distinctive tramp-tramp of stormtrooper boots could be heard even over the bar's music. Apprehension spurted through Tarvin. Commander Udre had said he was heading over to take Iden to see someone, to talk, to heal her. Why were there stormtroopers? He rose too, stepping forward and holding out a hand. "Hang on a minute, guys. There's some mistake. Iden and I are going to see Commander Udre. We were just leaving."
"Stand aside, Lieutenant Larika," came the clipped voice of a lead trooper. "Commander Iden Versio, you are under arrest for sedition. Please, come with us."
Iden's fist was still clenched. For an awful, wonderful moment, Tarvin honestly thought she was going to fight them. Then slowly, with visible effort, Iden relaxed her hand. She did not resist as two of them stepped beside her, one on each side, seizing her wrists and snapping a pair of stun cuffs on them. Then they grasped her upper arms with their armor-covered fingers and escorted her from the premises. Just as she was almost out the door, Iden looked over her shoulder. A look of haunted betrayal in her eyes was like a blaster bolt to his heart.
"Lieutenant," said the remaining stormtrooper. A hand closed hard on Tarvin's elbow. "I'll need you to come with me."
Tarvin felt the blood drain from his face as he stared into the black sockets of the trooper's helmet.
"What have you done?" Iden had said.
What indeed?
The daughter of renowned Admiral Garrick Versio of the Imperial Security Bureau and famous artist Zihei Versio may be a traitor to the glorious Empire,
holojournalist Alton Castle stated, with just the right amount of horror in his smooth voice.
Captain Iden Versio has been recorded as spouting lies about the Empire and inciting violence, denouncing the brave subjects of the Death Star battle station who lost their lives while she survived. This is not in keeping with the behavior of the highly decorated captain hitherto, but the words are damning. She is slated for an immediate court-martial. Hero of the Empire, Admiral Nasha Garvin, will prosecute, while the specialized legal analyst droid HM-12 will provide proper defense as required by Imperial Navy law.
Lieutenant Zha Ike, assistant to Admiral Garrick Versio, stared, mouth open, in an unprofessional, unconscious expression of shock as the story unfolded. Then he swallowed and straightened his gabberwool jacket. The Admiral needed to be told about this, and Ike could not imagine that his reaction would be pleasant. Still, Ike knew his duty. Versio was eating his lunch, a meal of steak, brightly colored roasted vegetables, and kuanut bread, as Ike rushed in without knocking.
"Sir," Ike began, his voice tense and strained, "your daughter..."
The young man fell silent as he realized his employer was already watching. His back to Ike, Versio simply held up a hand. Ike remained quiet and breathed deeply, attempting to recover his composure during what surely had to be the worst public relations disaster the Admiral had ever had to navigate. Both men watched as images of Iden flashed on the vidscreen. Iden in stun cuffs, Iden surrounded by stormtroopers, angry crowds surging toward her as she was roughly shoved into a shuttle. Only after Castle had assured the viewers that the Holonet would continue to follow this shocking developing story did the Admiral wipe his mouth with a fine linen napkin and, still without turning, speak.
There's a datapad and a personal holoprojector on the corner of my desk. I imagine you're going to be swamped by journalists. The datapad is for you, the hologram for them. And that is all you're going to give them for the moment. Need I remind you, you are to say nothing to anyone about this unless I instruct you to. Ikape blinked, stunned. Damn, but the Admiral was a model of calm control. The Lieutenant was embarrassed at his own earlier distress. Of course, sir. Thank you. That will be all. Even though he had been dismissed, Ike lingered. Sir, is there anything you need? If there is, I'll ask, Versio said calmly. And Ike? Sir. Never, ever enter this room without knocking again. Of course not, sir. Apologies, sir. The door closed behind the chastened assistant. Versio continued to watch the breaking news, finishing his meal as they played Tarvin's recording over images of Aiden shamed and in stun cuffs, and smiled slightly.
Chapter 10.
As Sen diligently practiced her forgery skills in a dusty corner beneath a chunk of fake white munilinsed marble, she suspected, not for the first time, that Rudega was a bit too happy to have a slave to do his bidding. The merchant was a sly, singularly unpleasant Doug, who emitted a strange odor reminiscent of old cheese. His species had a long snout, from which dangled thin, fleshy tendrils and a squat body. More unusual was the fact that they walked on their arms and used their feet, which had long, dexterous toes, the way most other beings used their hands. He had been working with the Empire for as long as there had been one, he liked to boast.
Got the shop cheap back towards the end of the Clone Wars, he told Sen one evening. The former owner had been sniffed out by the Jedi for dealing in black market items. Fortunately, the Republic eventually became the Empire, and what it gained in worlds, it appeared to lose in scruples.
Then, seeming to recall exactly to whom he was speaking, he amended quickly.
Well, at least when it comes to little things like the black market.
Information is a useful commodity, Sen had replied. Sometimes the Empire must get its hands a little dirty for the greater good.
She had done her research on him, of course. Rudega had been useful as far as it went. But lately his tips hadn't panned out, and some of his sources had turned up dead. So he was quickly becoming a liability. She suspected he wouldn't be terribly missed. The shop was filled, if not with actual antiques, at least with things that were certainly old, some of which smelled as bad as the merchant who sold them. There was nothing resembling station security, as there had been on Telic 4, which was officially managed by the Empire. Here, each merchant had to hire their own thugs, and Rudega was no exception. The pair of Trandoshans who guarded the Doug and his merchandise were brothers. They were ugly and crude, but while they may have made comments in their own language, which Sen understood perfectly, they did so under their breath, and they did not overtly harass her. It suited her well enough. They wouldn't be around too much longer anyway. Versio had sent a few fake spies Rudega's way, to lend Sen's cover story some verisimilitude. He had been careful, though, to not select anyone who would recognize her. The spies accepted their data chips she gave them and dutifully carried them back to Navint. If they were foolish enough to attempt to break the code, they would receive false information. Few thought of Sen as someone with a sense of humor, but she was terribly amused by all of this. The day came at last. Sen had spent extensive hours in simulators and excelled in live-fire exercises, but her field experience was limited. She was looking forward to transitioning from the dim rooms with dozens of vid screens to a place where she could actively participate. Things were going to be quite different, starting in approximately... She heard the sound of blaster fire and screaming. Now, she amended,
Even as she scrambled to get out of her alcove, the Dug's foot shot out and dragged her from it.
Sen, what's going on? Is this part of your cover?
He anxiously shifted his weight from one hand to the other. She waved him furiously to silence.
Yes! Yes! She hissed. You'll be fine!
Until this moment, her world had been one of calmness, coolness, calculation, and focus. Now her heart was beating so fast.
This is all under control. Go and wait in your office. This will all be over in a moment. And take your Tandoshans with you. My contact is very skittish.
He grunted and hurried off to hide like the coward he was, his old cheese odor lingering in the air for a moment. One foot waved to his bodyguards, and they followed him into the office. Sen wrinkled her nose. Yes, the galaxy was going to be much better off without him. Outside, the screaming increased. Sen took a deep breath, remembering the helpless, frightened slave girl she was trying to be, and stumbled forward with such false panic, she tripped on an old statuette of the Vulcarian fertility god Kukwebi. Kukwebi's stone Spear of Desire stabbed her arm. It would leave a mark. Good. She used the sting to bring tears to her eyes. She went to the front of the shop, looking around as if in wild terror, but in reality assessing the situation. They were coming down the main corridor now. There were three of them. A male Kagi, a Twi'lek female, and a human male. Sen was quite certain they knew exactly what they were doing. This group was violent and willing to sacrifice themselves if necessary, but they were far from stupid. Some of the shops they ran straight past. Others they paused and fired into. Still other shops exploded as small, blinking devices were rolled inside. Sen had to time her move just right. It was a risk. Partisans of any stripe didn't care about collateral damage to civilian population, but they were skilled. She had to trust they wouldn't fire randomly or decide to kill someone just for the hell of it. There were three shops down. Two. Now, Sen ran out of the antiquities shop, sobbing, shouting, and pointing back the way she had come.
He's hiding in the office!
Her arms were bare so they could see the bruises and the freshly made injury courtesy of Kukwebi, and the neckline of her threadbare tunic revealed a slender throat encased in a shock collar.
Move!
Shouted the Kagi, his pale red eyes blazing and his skin the gray color of stone. He didn't slow his speed, leaping clear over her, hitting the corridor, and rolling to his feet in a staggering display of acrobatic athleticism. Sen was running out of the line of fire in a pattern that would bring her around behind the oncoming rush of dreamers. She was barely clear when they started firing, stepping in closer until they had reached the office door. If Rudega and the Tradotian guards screamed, the sound was drowned out by blaster fire. Once they were satisfied that Rudega would never send another message to the Empire, the dreamers moved on. As they turned and headed down the corridor towards their next targets, the Twi'lek, a female with rich teal coloring and striking purple eyes, paused long enough to give Sen a searching glance. Her eyes lingered on the shock collar. Then she followed her fellow rebels. And so did Sen. She raced after them, not begging them to take her, not yet. Just running with them and standing back and picking up pieces of debris to throw while the others used their blasters and their bombs. The smell of smoke and burnt flesh filled her nostrils and caused her to cough. How the human heard the sound over the cacophony, Sen didn't know. He spared her a quick, angry glance from hard eyes.
Get lost, kid!
He shouted. The dismissal was amusing, considering the speaker was obviously not much older than Sen.
Take me with you!
Sen cried.
I hated Rudega! I hate everyone here! Please!
They didn't reply, so she kept following, kept out of the way, and kept helping them. Finally, they seemed to have finished what they had come to do. Behind them, they left a trail of debris, fire, people wailing in fear and agony, and alarms wailing in belated, useless warning. And bodies. Lots of bodies. Sen had memorized the layout of the station down to some of the finest details, and she knew that Docking Bay 32 was up ahead. This time, instead of the dreamers creating corpses as they went, the floor in front of them was littered with the dead. Someone had cleared their retreat path. The three partisans and the human Imperial agent didn't slow.
simply leaping over the bodies and continuing on.
They had to be close to their vessel at this point.
Again, the Twi'lek glanced at Sen, but this time she shouted, "Get over here! Hurry!" Sen hurried, sprinting towards them and moving behind the Twi'lek. The human tossed a grenade back down the corridor the way they had come. It exploded with much more power than the ones they had used previously, and the resulting pile of rubble provided an effective block against any pursuit. Sen allowed herself an elated grin. This role she was playing, this Sen the slave, surely she would be ecstatic. There were two final bodies, sprawled at the entrance of the docking area proper. The human entered a code and the door slid open. Awaiting them on the other side was a ship, a little worse for the wear, but still spaceworthy. The portal to open space had already been opened, but a faint glow of blue light indicated the presence of a magnetic field. The ship's ramp was down. Standing on it and waiting for the Dreamers, as Miko had waited for Versio and Hask at Telic 4 not so long before, was a gray-furred, elderly Chadrafan. Barely a meter tall, with enormous ears and a snub-nosed muzzle set in a bat-like face, he peered, blinking shiny black eyes in shock at Sen, smaller than any of them except for himself, tagging along behind them.
"Piakow!" the Twi'lek shouted. "We have to get a collar off."
"Oh, dear," Piakow said, his ears twitching nervously.
"We don't really... Hang on."
He ducked out of sight as the partisans began to clatter up the ramp. A hand closed hard on Sen's arm, yanking her off her feet and spinning her around. It was the young human. "Not you," he said. "We'll try to remove the collar, but that's it. You're on your own." Sen stared at him, the horror in her eyes not entirely feigned. A firm embracer of redundancy, she'd had two different backup plans, but both were useless now that she was sealed on the wrong side of a collapsed corridor. If the Dreamers refused to take her with them, the plan would fall apart. She'd be able to get out of the station safely, of course. The Empire would see to that. But too much would be public knowledge, and the Dreamers now knew her face. The mission would be compromised. She would have to sit it out, and Sen couldn't bear that.
"Please, no!"
She put everything into the words.
"I'm trapped here now. They'll think I helped you."
"You should have stayed out of it." The human was implacable. But even as he spoke, the Twi'lek clattered down the ramp. She carried a small tool. "She comes with us," the Twi'lek snapped.
"But my mission, my rules."
The beautiful teal-skinned woman leaned down and gazed into Sen's eyes.
"What kind of collar is it?"
"Explosive," Sen said. "It'll go off if I leave the station or if it's removed improperly. Can you get it off?"
The decision for Sen to wear the collar was a risk, but a slave without one would be too suspicious. It was a safe bet that the partisans, who were constantly forced to improvise, would be able to remove the collar. And if not, Sen always carried the key with her. If worse came to worst, she could claim she had stolen it, but not know how to use it.
"Oh, no. We are not doing this," the man said. "Dana, you could kill us all."
No,
the Chadrafan insisted in his warbly, raspy voice.
"That's not how this works. It will delay the explosion, but not stop it, so you'll have to hurry."
"Got it," Dana said. She pressed the device to the locking mechanism on the collar. It whirred and hummed. Then there was a soft snick, and the lock opened. Quick as a thought, the Twi'lek grabbed the collar, sprinted back to the door, opened it, and flung the collar back down the corridor. She quickly closed the door, pivoted, and raced to the ship.
"Nadrine, get us out of here."
The ramp was already being retracted as Sen ran up it, dropping the now unnecessary collar key. Then it slammed shut behind her, and she was on the ship, diving for a seat and fastening the crash webbing as a fifth member of the crew, a tall human female with reddish-brown hair, was hitting buttons. Beside her, in a cockpit clearly never designed for a Chadrafan, sat Piakow, his tiny legs dangling as he operated a small handheld device.
"Magnetic field down in 3, 2,
he counted. The ship lifted off, hovered.
"1!
The glow that outlined the starfields disappeared. Faster than Sen had expected, the ship surged through the star-spotted darkness of open space. Behind them, there was an explosion from the corridor, and bright light from the portals flooded the cabin. The ship rocked, but kept going. A heartbeat later, the tiny dots that were stars turned into streaks of white as the partisans and their new ally made the jump into hyperspace. Everyone, it seemed, let out a collective breath. Then Dana spoke. "Cave, you're still new, so I'm going to cut you some slack." The young human partisan seemed startled and glanced at Sen before opening his mouth to respond. Dana cut him off.
"Never, ever question the leader of a mission. Whatever they do, if they say shoot, you shoot. If they say die, you die. And if they say take along the slave who's just fought on your side to the best of her ability, guess what? You do that too. Are we clear?" "The explosion. Are we clear?"
Sen had to admit, she'd held a stereotype of Twi'lek females as soft and kind. The one taking down a now-subdued human was nothing of the sort. She was a goddess of righteous anger, fierce and yet in perfect control, and the twitching of the long, graceful leku that fell from either side of her head was ominous rather than pleasant.
"Yeah," Kaeve said. "We're clear."
"Good. Okay. Everyone divest." They freed themselves from their crash webbing and got to their feet. All wore nondescript gray flight suits, which they began to unfasten. Sen watched in surprise. Flight suits weren't the most comfortable gear, but usually crews wore them until they reached their destinations. She became even more confused when they pushed their hands down the necks of their shirts. Sen began, and then fell silent when Dana brought something out and showed it to her. It was a small orb, similar to the explosive jewelry that Bok's partisans had worn at the Singularity. This one, however, and the others the two males were retrieving from beneath their clothes, wasn't painted or otherwise disguised as a clay bead. A small piece of what looked like black metal was attached to each one. Dana held out her other hand. In it was a detonator. Sen stared at the explosives, then up at Dana.
"We wear them all the time when we go on a mission," the Twi'lek said quietly. "In case something goes wrong, we don't want to be caught and tortured by the Empire. And sometimes we know we're on a one-way trip going in."
"I see," Sen said.
She knew the partisans didn't shy away from suicide bombings. She hadn't known that every mission had the potential to become one. The Kagi gathered up the personal-sized bombs and took them back to another part of the ship for safekeeping. Dana seemed to shake off the solemnity of the divesting.
"There, that's done. I don't know about the rest of you, but I always get hungry after one of these runs. Anyone else want anything?"
A chorus of no's greeted her, except from Kaeve, who decided to stay sullenly silent. Dana went to the compartment in the ship's bulkhead. She removed two ration cubes, a container of nutritive milk, and a single, spiky, slightly bruised, Malarin fruit.
"Go easy with that," the Kagi said as he returned to the main cabin. "We're getting low on, well, everything."
"Don't worry. Opportunity should be arriving soon," Dana replied.
"It had better, and if it doesn't, the Empire won't have to worry about us. We'll have all starved to death."
"We'll be fine. Even that growing boy of yours,"
Dana reassured him as she helped herself to the rations and walked over to where Sen sat. Sen let her eyes flicker up, then down. Dana sat down beside Sen and handed her a cube, the milk, and the Malarin. Sen accepted the milk and cube, but shook her head at the proffered piece of fruit.
"Thank you," she said, glancing at the Kagi. "But this is plenty."
Dana smiled a sad, bittersweet smile.
"I know those words," she said. "Those are the words of a slave."
"Want to know how I know?" Looking up at her cautiously, Sen nodded.
"I was a slave myself. Ever since I was an adolescent. The man who took me and half my village said how he liked
How I danced. Dana spat the word, then laughed humorlessly. He'd never seen me dance. She looked over at Sen. You ever have to dance for your master? When Sen shook her head, Dana nodded, looking a little relieved. Well, thank goodness for small favors. What did you do for him? Sen suspected the query came from a genuine place of concern, one slave to another. But by the way the others were listening now, she also knew there was a deeper layer to the question. They had just, to the best of their knowledge, risked their lives to free her and had taken her with them. They wanted to know what she might have done to help the Empire, and also could do for them. Slavers, rebels, they're all the same, she thought, and answered with what she hoped was the proper beaten-down shyness of a former slave.
I know Rudega was into some pretty bad things. Spying for whoever paid him, the black market. When he found out I knew how to read and write basic, he put me to work in his shop. I helped him with numbers, cataloging, that sort of thing.
But the actual former slave was shaking her head.
Honey, it's all right. I know you did more. You had to have done more, or else he'd just hire someone and pay them starvation wages.
Sen feigned hesitation, looked around at the faces that were now turned toward her. Except for Kaeve, who was still stinging from Dana's upbraiding, they seemed more curious than suspicious.
I have a steady hand and a sharp eye, she said. He put me to work forging. Letters, documents, you know, certificates of authenticity. Things to make stolen goods seem to be legitimate. Things like that.
Now even Kaeve was looking thoughtful.
Do you know languages?
Sen shook her head.
Only basic and Huttese. My master, Rudega, wanted to make sure I couldn't eavesdrop on some of his conversations. I'm sorry.
No need to apologize. When we get to the base, we'll see just how good you are at forging, Dana said. I know you're ashamed of what you had to do, but now you can turn that skill to something worthwhile. Something that matters. Do you know who we are?
No. I just know you killed Rudega and others who were helping the Empire, so I'm guessing you're rebels?
Of a sort, Dana said. We call ourselves the Dreamers. We are what's left of the real partisans, people like Saw Gerrera. I'm sure your master must have known about us.
Sen nodded solemnly, and Dana continued.
What you saw back there. We do things like that a lot. And sometimes we do things that seem cruel, but they're necessary. I think I can arrange for you to stay with us if you'd like to. Otherwise, we can take you somewhere safe.
Sen bit her lip and looked around.
You saved me, she said. I want to repay that. I'll stay with you, if you'll have me.
Dana looked around at her crew for a minute, the tips of her leku twitching as she pondered something.
Kaeve, you should go take a look at that new tool that got us our newest recruit. Piakau, you were telling me you could use it to do the same thing on thermal detonators, right?
The Kagi, and the human, of course, could see right through the Twi'lek's request, but the Chandrafan clearly didn't.
Absolutely!
Piakau's furry face was filled with enthusiasm.
Let me show you the schematics.
All three rose and went to the front of the cabin, allowing their commander and the new recruit some privacy. Gently, Dana took Sen's hand and placed the fruit in her palm.
It was a while before I told anyone, she said quietly. I felt ashamed. It took the mentor to show me that none of what happened to me was my fault. Maybe Rudega didn't make you dance. She indicated Sen's bare arms. But I can see the marks.
He wasn't a gentle master.
Did you ever try to kill him?
The words and the soothing, gentle voice in which they were uttered were such a bizarre juxtaposition that Sen lifted her eyes from her plate.
No, she said.
Even though the entire story was fake, somehow these words stung. Sen was fond of this character she'd created. She didn't want Sen the slave to look like a coward.
But I wish I had,
don't.
The Twi'lek was full of surprises.
Why not?
Sen asked.
Because that kind of killing is personal. And when it gets personal, it gets ugly. And some of that ugliness spills onto you.
She wasn't looking at Sen as she spoke. Her eyes were distant, unfocused. Sen had debriefed enough agents to know that expression. It tended to hang, like a miasma, only around those who knew from experience what they were talking about.
But isn't what you're doing personal? She inquired. Killing people, taking their lives, I mean, that seems personal to me.
It wasn't personal at all, but it seemed like the sort of thing Sen the slave would have asked.
You can't think of it like that, Dana said. You have to remember what we, and now you, too, are fighting for. We're fighting to end what happens to people like you and me. Oh, the Empire doesn't come out and endorse it officially. But I have danced a time or two for those who wore command caps. The Empire knows it happens, and they just don't care.
Her lovely face was hard as she continued.
They don't care about anything except themselves and that horrible, evil man who shuts himself away from everyone. They don't care about the billions whose worlds they've destroyed to get their medals or their kyber crystals or whatever the hell it is they're looking for this week. They don't care who dies or who lives. It's all for the glory of the Empire, honey. And don't you forget it.
I won't, Sen said earnestly. And she wouldn't either. The treasonous words were emblazoned in her memory. Smiling at Dana, she bit into the Mailerin.